Resources for Wednesday, March 28th, 2007. Open public hearing on House Bill 5024, Department of Forestry. Ms. Jordan, do you want to start off?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I put at your place a memo that gives you a historical perspective of the agency's revenue sources and their program expenditures, and then also a copy of the LFO analysis for your information. And we have the department here to present their budget.
Well, thank you very much. First graph kind of reminds me of a modern art version of Forested Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know what they say, art is the name of the beholder.
Yes. Well, Mr. Brown. Now, this morning, committee, I think what we'll be doing is going through an introduction and then probably through the tab two, I believe, of the presentation today. And I think this is going to work out pretty well because we'll get sort of a little bit in-depth, and then we'll come back to the Department of Forestry for virtually all of next week, or almost all of next week. So please start off whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. Our NAM analyst, Satish Padia, is here to join me at the table.
You may want to move the mic a little bit closer.
Okay. Is that better?
Yeah.
Does that work better? Okay. I'm going to give you just a real brief overview, and then I'll ask smart people to come up and talk about each of the programs. There's three pieces that you had asked for specifically in terms of the performance measures and the efficiency measures and priorities, and those will be talked about within each of our major programs. So I'm not going to hit those during the overview. Just give you just a few brief kind of big picture things. After I get done, our fire division chief, Paul Bell, will come up and work through the fire program. Monday, April 2nd, if our plan holds true, and if it doesn't, that's strictly, you know, you all's call. But where we have a kind of plan is on Monday, April 2nd, our division chief for state lands, Jim Paul, will go through that program, the state forest management program. Tuesday, April 3rd, Jim, who is also responsible for urban and community forestry, will cover that program. And then Ted Lawrence, and our division chief for private lands, will start on the private lands program. Ted will finish that on the 4th of April, and then we'll finish off with Clark Seeley, the associate state forester, talking about the administrative program. So that's kind of how we've got this organized, and we'll see if it works or not. In terms of overview, I mean, I think the thing everybody knows is forests are important in Oregon. They're half the land base. It doesn't matter if you're a hiker or a fisherman or a camper or somebody who's looking for a family wage job, or if you're a community that's looking for an economic base around which to support roads and schools. Forests make that difference in Oregon and many, many, many places. And the Department of Forestry's job is to contribute to that value. We do it by protecting the land. We do it by enforcing rules and regulations related to the land. We do it by helping others manage their land. And we do it by managing a little bit of it ourselves. But we have an integral role in securing that value for the state. 11% of the state's employment is related to the forest industry. 190,000 jobs around the state. Ownership of the property, for better or worse, is dominated by the federal government. And as we get into some of our discussions, we will note for you that that is a significant driver in everything that happens in forestry in Oregon, the fact that the federal government owns 58% of all the forest land in the state. Outside of that, forest industry, the typical large landowners own 21%. The smaller family forest landowners own 16%. We, the state, only owns 3% of the forest land in the state, and tribal and other public entities own about 2%. The thing that frames our work is what's called the Board of Forestry's Forestry Program for Oregon, and it's built around one basic concept that we call sustainable forestry. It's a concept that's evolved over the last 15 years in a number of international dialogue. It is a very mature concept from an international standpoint that says that sustainable forestry is about providing for the needs of the present while also securing the ability for future generations to meet their needs. And it's a concept that says in order to achieve that present and future security, forests need to provide a mutually dependent set of values that include economic values, environmental values, and social values. That it takes all three of those delivered on a forestry landscape for those lands to be sustainable over time. And the way we describe it is there's a very strong interdependence between those three sets of values. If you don't have cash money return from forests, then you can't afford to provide environmental protections. You don't have the dollars to provide environmental protection, and you don't have the dollars to provide recreational facilities or manage for aesthetics and do the other things that people want. You don't have the economic engine that provides community support for roads and schools. But by the same token, if you don't protect the basic environmental values of a forest, the soil, the water, the biological diversity, then you're undermining what in essence drive the economic value. So you have to protect environmental values if you're concerned about economic value. And on the social end, if you don't create that, what I would call emotional commitment to forests by things like caring about aesthetics, by providing for recreational opportunities, by respecting cultural values in forests. If those things aren't there to create the emotional commitment to forests, then people really won't let you manage the land for anything. They'd just as soon you turn it into a parking lot or something. So they are three sets of interdependent values, and they are what determine whether or not forests are sustainable over the long term. We don't think, and this is spelled out in the Forestry Program for Oregon, that all of those values have to be delivered in equal amounts on every acre. And we see that in how land uses are allocated in the state. Some lands are pretty strongly oriented toward the environmental values, like federal lands. Some are pretty strongly oriented toward economic values, like the industry land. And then a lot of lands are a pretty broad mix, including the state forest lands. Given kind of that overview, it's very general. I want to talk just a little bit about the key issues and drivers that we try to deal with, things that are out there that we know we need to pay attention to. The piece that's going to overlay all of these issues and drivers, though, is our capacity. The charts that were handed out to you this morning by LFO are good. They're interesting. They really display well. You can look at the differences between 97 and 97-99 and 07-09, and it shows an increase, but these are actual dollars. They don't reflect purchasing power, and if you were to factor in and try to evaluate our purchasing power change between 1997 and today, we are struggling to continue to sustain some of those values by our activities. We're struggling to keep fires small, which is our basic performance measure in the fire program. We're struggling to help landowners be successful in meeting their obligations under the Forest Practices Act and meeting their basic goals to have a well-managed, healthy forest. We struggle because, you know, positions have been lost. And at the same time that we've been kind of facing these capacity constraints, we have this ever-growing issue about more and more land conversion, fragmentation, development, pushing its fingers into the traditional rural landscape. And what that does to our capacity is drain resources. It makes fires more costly. It makes us spend more time on things like community wildfire plans. It draws us in, from the private landowner standpoint, draws our folks into a lot of not-in-my-backyard kinds of arguments where we spend inordinate amounts of time dealing with those fingers that are pushing out there into the traditionally rural, mainly working force landscapes. And in general, then, that takes what capacity we have and draws it down even further. So capacity really is kind of the color that shades every other issue driver we've got here. The ones that are listed in your overview are going, those are kind of the more resource related ones. Forest health certainly is one that people are aware of in the state. It is almost, wouldn't say exclusively, but almost exclusively a function of federal land management. Lands are not managed to the point where they are healthy anymore. They're overstocked. There's a high level of insect and disease. There's a poor ability to treat invasive species on those lands. But it doesn't stop at the boundary, unfortunately. It ends up being fires that we deal with, smoke that cities deal with, insect problems that private landowners deal with. But it is, frankly, driven off of the federal land issue. The second issue is viability of forest lands. I don't know how many of you all have been looking at, you know, what's going on lately, but large portions of the privately owned forest in Oregon have followed the same trends that are happening all over the country and have changed hands. They have moved from what were traditionally publicly owned integrated forest products companies into a more tax-advantaged structure called timber investment management organizations, real estate investment trusts, and have essentially separated themselves from the manufacturing facilities. And that's a change. The privately owned companies, like, don't want to get too specific, but such as Roseburg, don't have the same tax challenges, and they're still integrated. In terms of the publicly owned companies, there's only one in the country that essentially is still managing timberland and manufacturing facilities, and they happen to be very, very prominent here in Oregon. It's Weyerhaeuser Company. But they're essentially the only one left in the United States doing that. And that has created change. Every time the land changes hand, a little bit is spun off for smaller tracts, for potential development. In addition, the fact that the federal properties are not managed for timber has reduced infrastructure in the eastern part of the state. We've lost, you know, most of our milling capacity and logging capacity in many parts of the eastern Oregon. When that happens, private landowners can't sell their timber because it's too costly. Where they used to have a 50-mile haul to get logs to a mill, now it's a 250 or 300-mile haul to get logs to a mill, and they simply can't afford to manage for timber anymore. So they start looking at other things to do with their forest land, and it has this kind of downward spiraling effect where supply gets constrained, manufacturing facilities go away. As they go away, the markets go away. When the markets go away, the landowners get out of the business and constrain supply even further. And it's a cycle that's got a very strong grip on eastern Oregon right now. And it's tough to get around. And again, it's built around the federal land issue, but it affects the viability of all the forest land. In terms of federal forest land, we're not funded to spend huge amounts of time dealing with the issue, but we scrape and put together what capacity we can to try to make a difference, try to interact with that issue on a number of different levels. The first being protection. We work very closely with the federal land managers on fire protection in the state. And in fact, are successful because of that close relationship. It's one that frustrates a lot of people a lot of times because they would appear to some people to have a different attitude about fighting fire than we do. But regardless of any disagreements we have about approach, we need them and they need us, and we work spend a lot of time cultivating that relationship and trying to make sure it works smoothly. We've started to have some discussions about actually contract protecting more of their property. Right now we do that for about 2.2 million acres of BLM land. It makes sense to me personally that we do more of that around the state. I think in the end, the synergies that would be created would save taxpayers money, and it could in fact alleviate some of our critical mass funding issues that we've got in some parts of the state, like Eastern Oregon, where private land values have gone down to the point where it's difficult for them to actually pay for fire protection. And I think if we could bring in another set of acres that we contract and get paid to contract for, building that critical mass of protection capability back up would help with the private landowners a little bit. We've engaged in a lot of discussions with them, and hopefully one of these days we'll actually pull off a project to help them manage some of their properties through the stewardship program. We have signed on, the state of Oregon has, to be a cooperating agency in the development of their new management plans. The governor signed that cooperative agreement, and we are the lead agency bringing in the comments from all the other state agencies, ODFNW, DEQ, and so on. And the governor has also asked the Board of Forestry to engage in a process of bringing together citizens and trying to define for the state of Oregon what is Oregon's vision of what these federal lands should be contributing. To see if we can't in some way get people around a unified view of what the lands and federal lands in Oregon should be doing, and use that as a way to try to influence both their plans on the ground and as a way to influence federal policy, because much of what prohibits that policy right now, or much of what prohibits that vision right now, is federal policy, and we have to work in that area. Moving on, state forests. Again, 3% of the land, 99.9% of the conversation, seems like a lot of times, certainly the media coverage. And, you know, not facetiously, a lot of what we do in state forests is driven by that disagreement over how those lands should be managed. We spend a lot of time interacting with stakeholders. We spend a lot of time collecting information so that we can be very transparent about what we're doing, how we're doing it, what we're getting done. It adds to cost to do that, but it's part of being a public land manager, is to create that high level of accountability. There's some issues around consolidation of tracts that Chair Devlin has mentioned to me, and it's certainly, I think, something that we need to explore in the name of management efficiency. And there's also a bill making its way through the Senate that would authorize us to acquire new lands, and I think there's a place for us to do that, particularly lands that are at risk of moving out of the working forest category. We've done that successfully in the past, where the lands just sat there. They had no immediate economic value, so nobody was going to pay attention to them, take care of them, and nurture them. The state has the kind of time frame where they can do that, that they can bring those lands back to a healthy and productive state, and I think there's a role for us to do that. The final driver is our business systems. They're horrid, is the best way to put it. They're really, really bad is maybe a different way to put it. You know, it covers every piece of our program. The transaction records that we may use to manage our timber sale program, our ability to interact with landowners and enforcement of the Forest Practices Act. It's hugely manual. There's no integration between programs. There's no integration between our transaction records and those required to drive the state system. We have not even begun to access some of the technology that's out there that would help decision systems terms of library programs, cataloging programs, and things like that. It's miserable. And the reason it is because there's been this poor integration of it in the past. It says, well, okay, you know, the legislature's only going to give us so much money. We either can fight fire or we can buy computers. And there's never been this integrated discussion that says buying computers is as much about fighting fires as it is anything else. And we've got to get past that. We've got to understand that these business systems are an integral part of being effective at fighting fire, managing land, helping landowners. And it's a very important need that the department has. I just tell one story and then I'll quit. After the 03 season, we had several large project fires in the John Day area. It was the first year that I was here as a state forester. And that winter, I was back in the John Day area, and I went upstairs, and there was one great big room up there. It's about half the size of this room. And there was a big pile of boxes full of paper over in that corner, and there's a big pile of boxes full of paper over in that corner, and another one over here. And those were the paperwork that had yet to be processed in order to do all the financial accounting and reconciliation for three project fires. And it was going to take a couple of people all winter long to do that. That's the condition of our business systems at this point. So it is a serious need. I'm going to stop there, see if you have any questions about the overview or if you would like for me to bring Paul up.
Saving for the following people.
Good. Looks like they want you, Paul.
Okay. Please come forward and identify yourself for the record and go ahead and start whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. I'm Paul Bell with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I am the Protection Division Chief. I'll kind of just try and take up from where Marvin left off and dive into the fire program and to a lot more specifics. And I will be following pretty close to the presentation notebook that you have. So if you have questions in there that I don't hit, be sure and bring them to my attention. The key big issues and budget drivers for the department's fire protection program can be divided basically into policy drivers and capacity issues. All of the drivers and issues have an effect on one or more of our key performance measures, and as you look in your notebooks, I've listed those performance measures in conjunction with each of the issues. And then when we get to the performance measures, I can get into a little bit more detail. Maybe start with slide 5, and I don't know how well these will work. If they don't, we won't worry about them. They're not too much. But the first policy driver I wanted to hit on was climatic changes and forest health. In recent years, the West has experienced intensive fire seasons due in part to weather trends conducive to extreme fire conditions. For the last several years, we've seen our fire danger indices meet or exceed our standard average worst conditions. And this slide kind of depicts that. But climatologists predicted this trend will continue for us for the next several decades. Our fire protection budgets are typically developed related to past statistics and experiences that we've had. They typically include some monetary increases for inflation factors, but they don't really adjust too much, taking into account future climate changes. As we looked, it's based on past history. We build from there and then try to make adjustments. What this slide depicts is it is an energy release component chart for our Central Oregon area. It lays out what the expectations are for large fire potential within that geographic area. The main driver for it are the energy release components. Energy release components are basically a measure of energy that's derived out of the head of a flaming front of a fire. It relates to the conditions of your fuels, basically, both as your live fuels cure down and as your dry fuels or your dead fuels get drier. But the point I wanted to make with this is the blue line basically represents the energy release components for the 2006 fire season for Central Oregon. The skinnier dark line there in the middle is the actual rolling 10-year average for the energy release components for the area. And so just trying to show the difference between how much we're running above the average last season, as well as even expanding outside of one standard deviation from the average. And this just is, I mean, this was 2006. 2005 showed pretty much the same thing. Each year as we're progressing, so far we seem to just keep stepping up incrementally in severity for those conditions in regards to the weather. Unless you had any questions on that. The next component of this issue is in regard to forest health. As Marvin had mentioned, the colors come out on that different than what I had denoted here. But the orangish colors represent, what this is a fuels conditions map and reflects the changes of, or the severity of the fuels as they built up over time in Oregon. The orangish color represent the most extreme condition class changes that we've had. And then the lighter green represent the moderate changes. But you can kind of see the distribution over the state of this. The wildland or wildfire fuels have accumulated to uncharacteristically high levels, mostly in our drier forest ecosystems, causing fire risk frequency, intensity, severity, and size to increase. Fire return intervals, fuel accumulations, and other fire regime characteristics are no longer within their historical range, which this slide depicts. Dense stands of small trees resulting from fire exclusion policies and other land uses are more prone to being killed by insects and disease, thus increasing the fuel load even greater.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Would you define a little more specifically what constitutes fuels?
Basically anything that'll burn in the forest. I mean the woody loading, brush loading. In reference to dense stands, we have a lot of suppressed, like white fir, pole size type timber. The in relation to the buildup you get on the ground, you also get a buildup of ladder fuels in that understory of the canopy, where we used to have fire running through the forest more on a more average return cycle. Those fuels are cleaned up in those types of fires.
Yes.
I'm done. Just checking, and that's mostly on federal land now that we're talking about. I mean, since half of the forest land is federal, and you only have 2% state land, that's basically all federal land that we're looking at there.
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, that's the most extreme conditions are mostly on the federal forests. But even the lighter green depicts into the private lands also. So we've been excluding fire for quite some time on private lands. We have the opportunity to manage it in regards to managed forests, and so it's not as. But again, there's still some buildup in that.
In your presentation, could you? For the lay person here, not for Representative Burley over there. But could you point out the challenges that this presents? I mean, in terms of containing fires in these areas, and also maybe what it means in terms of as a lay person, I have a limited understanding that's. Depending upon the type of forest fire that you have, if you have that much built up in terms of energy sources, and the more permanent damage that can occur in that kind of situation versus what we might have experienced in a forest fire 30 or 40 years ago.
Chair Devlin, kind of getting at your question, you know, the larger the fuel buildup, the more severe the weather conditions are, the more intense the fires burn. It takes a lot more a couple things occur in that process. The more severe the fires burn, we see things like long-range spotting out in front of the fires as they build up ahead of steam and get moving, which ends up creating fast-moving fires as they go through. Those types of activities take a lot of resources to try and slow them down, stop them, get them under control. Again, the more, you know, the drier the fuels are, the more of them are, and the warmer the weather is, it just creates a much more difficult situation to handle. In regards to the damage, those fires burn much more severe, where historically maybe they wouldn't have burned so strong through a riparian area on a creek. Now they'll blast through and basically nuke it where there's no coverage left afterwards. You know, damage for wildlife. Am I getting to
set? So, please proceed.
When you talk about fighting forest fires, it doesn't make any difference whether it's federal land or private land or state land. You guys are out there leading the charge as fighting the fires.
Senator Nelson, we are specifically charged with the protection of private and state forest lands and some of the BLM lands in western Oregon. That's our statutory authority to do. The Forest Service is responsible for the federal lands. We work in, as Marvin mentioned earlier, we work in partnership. We have, I think, very good partnerships in place with the Forest Service in regards to helping them. They help us. We, you know, resources become scarce. We work together to share those resources, putting them into the highest priority areas at the time where the greatest amount of threats are.
It's the budget committee. The state pays for that. Fed pays. The feds pay part of that, too. How does that work out? That goes back into our coffers then? Or is there some sort of relationship? They have most of the state, the lands, and they pay most of the cost? Or how do we?
Most definitely. Each of the agencies are responsible for all of their costs on the lands that they have the jurisdiction on. So when we fight fire on the Forest Service, we are reimbursed by the Forest Service. And in fact, this committee here about a week ago heard, I think it was Senate Bill 5545 in regards to, we did that a lot last year. We managed the shake table fire for them. They're reimbursing us. They reimburse us for all those costs. Well, what that creates, and I was going to touch on that a little bit later, is we end up bumping up against our limitation authority. We have dollars to cover it, but we don't have limitation, and that's why we're in often asking for that. And the same applies when the Forest Service is on. We're using Forest Service resources. We have to reimburse them.
I talk about the Ryan concept.
I may, Paul, just to kind of follow up on the chair's question about the fuels. I think it'd be helpful for the committee to understand, you know, how we measure tons of fuel per acre, the significance of that in the different fuel models when we're looking at fire activities or fire characteristics, and also the difference for the committee's benefit between the light fuels versus the heavy fuels and what that does to burn intensity and the damage to the resources. I think that'd be helpful for the committee to hear that.
Okay, Representative Burley, I'll try and explain that. All of our fire danger indices calculations are based on certain fuel models that exist or classified into light fuels, grasslands, the reprod or young second growth timber to middle-aged timber to old-growth timber, and as different tonnages of the fuel loadings that exist on the ground within those conditions. And so each one, the heavier it becomes, or also the geographic area that it's in within the state, all work together to calculate the intensity of the fire.
Mr. Chair, my point is that when you get some of these very overstocked stands, as what Paul's slide indicates with these heavy fuel loads, these are some of these areas in the Blue Mountains are hundreds of tons of fuel per acre, which is, you know, many times what is estimated to be natural. So, and they're very heavy fuels. They're, I don't know, 10 plus hour, you know, fuels. So that means when the fire gets in there, it just sits and cooks. It actually bakes the soil to where it becomes hydrophobic, and it creates all sorts of problems post-fire for restoration. And that's one of the things that we try to do on the public lands particularly, is reduce that fuel level down to a point that when fire does go through there, whether it's introduced naturally or by man, that it burns more quickly with a lower intensity and you don't have the resource damage. So that's, you know, a lot of the forest thinning and those types of activities that we try to do is to try and reduce that fuel load down so that the fire is not so destructive and not that hard to control.
One thing that gets a little bit at Senator Nelson's question is what we call the rind concept that's been implemented over the last year. And on a lot of these federal lands, particularly if they're wilderness designated, they have a set of restrictions about how they can fight fire on wilderness areas. That means it's more difficult to keep them from stopping at the boundary. And that, in the end, generates a cost for us when those wilderness fires burn off of wilderness and onto private land that we protect. In a normal property where they can fight fire aggressively, they go in, they'd stop it, and it would never reach our boundary line. But in wilderness, where they're it's a let burn policy, it runs over the line, and then we start incurring cost. And so what we have negotiated with the Forest Service is what we call a rind around each of those wilderness areas, that they will cover the cost for our fighting fire on private land within that rind, just for that specific reason. So it is something of a recognition that the way they fight fire adds to our cost sometimes. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's and I apologize. Actually, what we've been talking about has moves into my second point, and that is the differences in private and state forest management and protection priorities versus the federal lands. And so I won't touch too much more in that, but I would capitalize on some of the discussion we've had on this is when we do get fires in those situations, the compounding factor that occurs is that those types of fires then become what we call suppression resource black holes, and these are fires like the Biscuit Fire in 2002, the B&B in 2003, and that they're immense fires. They end up pulling resources in from the state as well as nationally to control and further impacting then the abilities of the protection agencies to hit initial starts as we move along. So it's just a compounding problem. I guess slide 15. The next issue I wanted to hit was the wildland-urban interface. The continued siting of dwellings and related improvements on forest land in the wildland-urban interface results in increased costs and risks, while also restricting the methods that we use for our firefighting tactics and our strategies employed by the firefighters. Increasing costs not only for the department, but also for other agencies such as the State Fire Marshal's Office and our rural fire departments that we work in partnership with. The Wildland Urban Interface Protection Act has, or what used to be we refer to as Senate Bill 360, has been very effective in addressing some of these issues, but do want to point out that a large amount of work remains to be completed in the implementation across the state of the Act, as well as a lot of the work that's been done under that Act has been completed with federal funding sources, which are starting to decline and less become available for that kind of work. And then one more point is additionally, the types of forest landowners, as Marvin had talked about a little bit earlier, are changing, which tend to create smaller parcel sizes and then fewer landowners with readily available equipment and personnel to draw in to assist in fire suppression. As some of the industry resources have gone away, we don't. They used to have you know, large resources of manpower for fighting fires from the mills, as well as equipment, water tenders, and those types of things. The next point is in regard to smoke management and air quality is one of our drivers. I don't have a slide for that, so I'll leave this one up here. But accurate and timely forecasting and data collection and analysis of fuels are vital components for us to maintain compliance with the Federal Clean Air Act. The department is responsible for meeting expectations for increased monitoring of fuels and management activities and smoke production related to wildfire and prescribed fire on public and private timberlands for our smoke management program. Additionally, as we're seeing as Oregon's population has increased in the wildland-urban interface, the opportunity for forest health issues related to smoke from forest lands have also increased. So we are charged with managing the smoke from prescribed fires. We've recently went through about a three-year review of our smoke management program and are implementing changes, and you'll hear about some legislation in regards to that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I do have a question about that. And when you were talking about fuels management, I mean, how big a factor does prescribed burning play into, you know, our ability to suppress the large fires, and how much is it used? I know that the smoke management plan is a big part of that, and you do have legislation. I'm very aware of that. But, you know, my observation, I spent a lot of time in our forests and up in Washington and California, and spent a lot of time in the Sierra Nevada, and it just seemed like prescribed burning was used much more often as a tool down there than it was up here. And I don't know if that's different federal, you know, Forest Service districts, and, you know, our policies working with the Forest Service. Do we sort of dictate when they can do prescribed burning based on our smoke management plan, or how does that interaction work with the federal forest fire suppression tools?
Chair Devlin, Representative Dingfelder, in Oregon, the Oregon Smoke Management Plan does cover all private and federal, all forest land prescribed burning. We do regulate the Forest Service for their prescribed burning and for their forest health. We produce daily instructions with limits for the amount that can burn on the particular day in regards to what the airshed will hold, as well as to what the weather conditions are. So we do regulate it, and that is pretty similar to Washington. I'm not as familiar with California, but we do coordinate. Our forecasters coordinate somewhat on a daily basis between the two states, talking about the amounts that are going to be burned.
The level of burning that the Forest Service can do is going to be constrained by the fuels that are on there right now, too. And if in most of these stands, if they haven't gone in and thinned first, there's too much fuel for them to actually use prescribed fire. It's going to have a big influence on the amount of prescribed fire they can use. They simply haven't got everything thinned to a level where it's safe at this point.
Sure. What's the difference between the land ownerships and the objectives for using prescribed fire and thus the amount that they use it, you know, between the federal, state, and private lands?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley. Probably one of the main differences, most of the prescribed burning that occurs on private lands is in relation to harvest activities and trying to treat the fuels that are left from after harvesting and preparing the sites for reforestation to get them planted. Burning's very effective, one at reducing the fuel loadings, and two, cleaning things up well enough so the landowners can get good reforestation in place. And on federal lands nowadays, it's predominantly in regards to forest health burning and trying to work to get the forest back into more of a condition that has reflected the natural fire regimes that have come through the area. So in a lot of instances, and there's a really good demonstration site outside of Metolius, or out of Camp Sherman, the Metolius demonstration area, where they've worked with different fuels treatments, and then in combination with prescribed burning. The basic differences.
Well, isn't part of the problem with when you're getting more homes being located in forest areas is that, you know, using prescribed burning as a tool, and you're going to get more complaints from people about the smoke, and you know that's one of the issues that I've heard. I mean, if we're not able to use it on a regular basis and could reduce the fire load or the, you know, energy load for larger fires. I mean, this was a naturally occurring, I don't know how many years it was, a regular cycle here in the Northwest, but my understanding, at least on the east side, is pretty regular basis. And that's what I've heard is the big concern when we have more and more homes being built in the urban forest interface that you can't use it as a tool
as frequently. Representative Dingfelder, you know, Western Oregon fire regimes basically, you know, range from 100 to 400 years on the, you know, from the crest of the Cascades out to the Coast Range. Eastern Oregon can be, you know, 15, 20 year natural regimes. So, yeah, the burning, you know, is making up for a lot of lost time in some of those instances. But in regards to the population, the Oregon Smoke Management Plan, its objectives is to keep the smoke out of populated areas, and the more spread population you have in some of these areas, it becomes pretty difficult to direct the smoke where it doesn't come into those areas. And so but the priority and the laws are aimed at the population centers. That doesn't help the folks that have moved into these other areas and have smoke sensitive problems.
Senator Nelson.
The department has been involved with the workforce over the interim, and as I understand from the workforce, one of the real issues is federal management. The individual forest federal guys haven't really grasped the idea that they got to clean out their forests, and so that's hindering your folks in trying to make the forest more healthy. Is there, can you comment on that? I mean, what's the progress as far as your workforces are concerning with the interim?
Well, I might start off first, Senator Nelson, then defer to Marvin. But I would, you know, one tool that you may have heard about, the OIG audit of the Forest Service in regards to their fire protection priorities and how the costs are being incurred for the federal government as they're looking at different ways to adjust for those costs. One of the issues coming out of that is for the Federal Land Management Agencies use a tool they call wildfire use prescription, which is to let a naturally ignited fire burn to reduce those fuel loadings in those cases. And you know, concerns we have with that is those are occurring in during high fire danger types of seasons. They do go through a process to monitor them and work them, but the probability of, you know, there is the probability that they become escape wildfires, bringing in additional resources. But, I mean, using that as a tool for fuels management versus using, you know, on-the-ground management, we do have issues with that.
That's in terms of individual forests and whether they're really aggressive at taking care of fuels problems or not. There's differences certainly all over the region. Region 6 of Forest Service. I think, you know, the overriding influence though is budget. they just simply are not funded to treat all the acres that need treating. And I'd hate to throw out numbers, but I'm guessing that in any given year they can treat about a tenth of the acres that need treating based on the budget resources they have available. Representative Burley may have a better figure than me on that because he looks at those things a little more closely, but that would be my guess, that they probably get funded to do about a tenth of the work they need to do.
Well, we should probably move on to the capacity-driven portion of your...
You bet. Thank you, Senator Bedlin. The next five budget drivers are capacity-driven. Item five is capacity to continue to meet resource protection targets or minimizing cost plus loss. The fire program provides fire prevention and suppression on about a half of Oregon's forest at about 15.8 million acres. It's primarily private land along with state-owned forests and some federal forest land on the west side, our BLM contract that Marvin mentioned earlier. ODF's budgets to provide a level of protection sufficient to respond to an average worst fire season, and I kind of touched on that earlier. The cost of putting out wildfires is raising at about 6 to 12% each year. For about the last seven biennia, the budget has not kept pace with inflation. And a couple examples of that, I was a district forester for the Cascade District starting in about 1999. When I come onto the district, a load of air retardant cost us about $3,000, for every drop that comes out there. In 2006, last fire season, the cost of a load of a retardant averages about $9,000 to $12,000, and so these are the types of increases that we're dealing with. A helicopter, the Weyerhaeuser ship out of Springfield in 1999 cost about $1,500 per hour. Now it's at $2,500 per hour. Talk is it could be going to $3,000 per hour. So the things tied to aviation are zooming out way in front of what average inflation factors are. And as we talk about, these capacities, these are the types of costs we're dealing with that we haven't kept up with in being able to cover those. Further reductions in the fire program's buying power will reduce the number of people and equipment available to attack fires aggressively. I mean, we've got to buy this... It all has to come from somewhere, so it ends up coming out. This jeopardizes ODF's ability to maintain success in suppressing more than 94% of the fires at 10 acres less, which is our main performance measure. Broad trends, already get fuel loading and all that, I won't go in there. But and then I've already talked about Senate Bill 5545 in regards to... Our limitation that we receive on a biennial budget or biennial basis, we do need to return frequently to ask for that to be increased. In fact, since 1987, ODF has asked for additional limitation 12 times. There's workload associated with that.
We like you.
Item six.
It's slightly.
Addresses aviation resource shortage. The availability of critical aerial suppression resources has become limited in recent years. The federal government currently has 16 large air tanker tankers on contract available nationwide, with the possibility we may see three more this year. This is down from 45 when the federal fleet was at full strength in 2002. As we have seen, this makes reliance on the federal air tankers in Oregon a daily game of chance. For the federal air tankers, we keep competing nationally for those, and the day we have our big fire, they may be all up in Montana and not down here. And this is all building up to the spatial purpose appropriation and SPA, but this is one of the air tankers that we've contracted with for a state resource under direct state control. Additionally, coal, when needed, helicopters have become increasingly scarce during the peak of fire season in recent years due to increased use by the federal government as the air tanker fleet has dropped down much more heavier reliance on helicopter resources. Widespread fire activity, it's bad all over. Sucks up the resources, and then also for helicopters, there's been an increase in worldwide demand for the equipment. So what I'm leading up to here is in when we operate under the call when needed scenario, that works real fine when those helicopters are out there and we can go pick them up on the day when the fire severity increases. But if they're not, then we can't get a hold of them and we don't have them available for our use. Funding for these resources have been provided largely through a legislative emergency board spatial purpose appropriation of general funds, and that's my next issue is the spatial purpose appropriation. A legislative emergency board spatial purpose appropriation, or SPA, has been established in each of the past three bienniums, explicitly separate from the department's fire protection budget.
And can I get slide nine?
To help the department carry out its fire suppression mission during extreme fire conditions that exceed the capacity of budgeted resources. And this is a fire about of in Northeast Oregon last year. Actually, what it is, just to explain the slide real quick, is this is one basin. There's actually three fires in this basin, one right below you here, one over on this hillside, and it's washed out, but one on down the drop. This is one of our air tankers on contract. This occurred, I mean, there's many fires all over after a big lightning bust, but how we use these resources most effectively is on these initial starts like this, getting air tankers, helicopters out in conjunction with our ground sources, hitting these fires with a very aggressive initial attack. In this instance, this air tanker split its load, dropped half of it on this fire here, come back around and hit the other side. None of these fires escaped initial attack, and that's the objective within all of this. It's just very, very, very efficient. I get wound up about air tankers. The 2005 legislature passed House Bill 2327, which identified the process for preparing the SPA request. It identifies four specific purposes for appropriating general funds to the Department of Forestry. It mandates the state forester to use critical discretion in the expenditure of the funds pursuant to the separate budget request required as part of this statute, and requires us to report to the emergency board each year after the close of the fire season to explain how we use those resources. Dollar amounts appropriate for the SPA have been identified to comply with the requirements of House Bill 2327. And I apologize. I've been confused in this process of how to bring the SPA forward. And so the documentation I've got prepared for you in your books is somewhat different than just what I'm going to run through here pretty quickly. However, it's all in there. It's just in different places. So. But the four specific purposes for the SPA are, one, providing funds for the purchase of insurance, our catastrophic fire insurance. And for this biennium, we're predicting at about $1.2 million. It actually could be lower. We are just now getting the quotes in place for the insurance for this fire season. And based on the record that we've had the last couple of years and not getting into the insurance, being successful with our initial attack, we are projected to see about a 16% to 19% decrease in the premium for this year. So probably about a savings of about $100,000 from dirty in regards to the general funds portion of the cost purchase of that insurance for this year. So where I'm going with that is the cost for the insurance next biennium, if we keep being successful, could be a little bit lower for the premium. The next item is placement of centrally managed fire suppression resources for statewide use, and item three is acquisition of fast-moving short-term contingency resources for use based on predictions of unusually severe fire weather. And then item four is enhancement of forest protection districts' resources in limited cases where land productivity or other economic factors seriously limit their capabilities, and basically talking about Eastern Oregon. So the other three components of the SPA that we have proposed are funding the air tankers for next biennium at about $2.3 million and funding helicopters on contract for about $2.5 million and then about $500,000 for severity engines and crews. Now, the significant difference in the SPA request this time based on the last couple of ones. And what page number is that?
226, if you're looking for the detail.
Yeah. The significant difference this time around in the SPA is we are requesting to enter into contract agreements with helicopters as opposed to using them as a call when needed resource. This is more of an upfront cost in doing this, in that we those become agreements. We are on the hook to pay for that contract through the fire season, or through the number of days that we sign the resource up. The plus side of that is it guarantees we will have those helicopters. We're paying for the availability of them. Kind of the downside of it is call when needed. You're not carrying that cost for the whole year. So I hope I'm making sense there. The point I'd really make with that is that by picking those helicopters up on contract, is we know we've got them in regards to the fire season. When we use them on fires, the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund or the district's budgets or the forest, somebody else is paying for them when we use them for the actual fire. The general fund is only paying for them in regards to having them available. So why the costs are at for the helicopters or the air tankers are at 2.3 or 2.5 million. That's kind of the worst case scenario at the end of it all. This is kind of hard. If we have a really bad fire season, there's a lot of fires out there, then the cost is going to be less for the SPA. On the other hand, it's going to cost somebody else a lot more.
Does that make sense?
It's a really important point.
The availability is paid for out of the general fund, but once they actually get deployed, they get paid for by whoever's fighting that fire. So then the general fund isn't tapped, actually, basically. So
just my own curiosity, the helicopters, in a sense, probably performing the same duties as the tankers. Are we talking about something that's like a giant Sikorsky helicopter, or what? Or about
Senator Devlin? I wouldn't say they perform the same duties. When we're talking about helicopters for the SPA, we're only talking about one, like a giant Sikorsky. That's a Type 1 ship. Predominantly, what we would use the SPA for are Type 2 ships, which are a medium, mid-range type helicopter. The difference being that size helicopter drops about 300 to 400 gallons of water, as compared to a Sikorsky that may drop 1,000 gallons of water. We use the helicopters, the different sizes of helicopters, basically based on fuel types, real heavy fuel loadings, the large wood, a larger drop is much more effective on those, and grass or lighter fuel types, the lighter helicopters, even Type 3, is effective, and they're faster in their turnaround. Air tankers, conversely, are used to lay down fire lines, or to reinforce fire lines, or to put in something in front of the fire or on the edge of the fire to cool it down to allow ground resources to get in and get the fire lines constructed. So kind of two different uses there.
One thing also, if you might comment on, Mr. Brown, if you would want to comment, the discussion we had yesterday, which might relate to this general area whenever you think it's appropriate, about why there's some things you might want to include in your base budget and some things that you may not want to include in your base budget.
Right, Senator Devlin. An important part to keep in mind here is when these funds are essentially identified as emergency funds, then in certain situations where a fire qualifies for FEMA reimbursement, and that happens essentially when a community is threatened of so many houses, when it qualifies for FEMA reimbursement, we can get reimbursed for up to 21 days of availability cost before that fire ever started. And that in some years has ended up bringing a fair amount of money back to the state to reimburse the general fund. I think one year it was $2 million, last year it was $1.9 million in 2004. Last year we're estimating to be about $275,000. But if we pay for the plane and it's identified as part of our regular budget, then it's not qualified for FEMA reimbursement. FEMA has to feel like it's coming out of some emergency expenditure of the state.
Please proceed. Representative Grog.
I just a comment and a question. when I had my radio stations in Clown Falls, they were up on a mountaintop, and we were surrounded by a fire one day, and I learned don't stand too close to where they're dropping that stuff when it comes down on you. It'll ruin a white shirt. My question is, and I'm assuming that you have already done a study on the state purchasing its own aircraft versus continually contracting year after year.
I'm going to refer to my program director. We have looked at for any specifics here, we have looked at in general at different costs. I mean, for the state to get into the aircraft business, we would be talking a lot of dollars. I was just down at a training session in Sacramento with the California Department of Fire and was able to see their aviation facilities. The state of California does run their own program, but just for their annual support and maintenance, it's $25 million for the ships and the helicopters, and the ships that they're using are basically have been federal excess that they've picked up over time. That now they're to the point in time the parts aren't available for them. They have them specially made to keep the ships functioning, but they're having conversations with their legislature in regard to now going out and purchasing replacement ships at basically $8 million a pop.
I would just say it's the reason it works well is because the ships that we contract for a few months during the year, the owners of those ships are paying for them by also working in Arizona or Alaska or Colorado during other parts of the year when we don't need them. And if we had to pay those costs, then the program would be a lot more expensive than just paying for them during the months when we need them. The operator does fine because those ships are moving all over the country, to do similar things. Fire seasons vary all over the country, right? It's fire season in Tennessee and Missouri right now. And they, in fact, used an air tanker in Tennessee I saw just the other day. So it may be the same air tanker that comes here in July.
That answered my question.
Please proceed.
All right. I'll move on. Just to close out the SPA portion, we are requesting at this point in time a total of about $6.73 million be allocated for that. The next item, and Marvin had hit this pretty good earlier also, but is the business capacity for the improvement for the program. The fire program's current business practices used for firefighting remain virtually unchanged from those used for the past 30 years. At the same time, the accountability, complexity, and cost of fighting fires has changed dramatically. The agency simply cannot adequately staff more than one large project fire with enough personnel to accomplish the hand-done business systems that are in place right now. We have several examples of improvement, and they're in the book, and I'll move on. I'm running short on time, unless you want me to get into that more.
Please go ahead.
And then the last driver that we have is what Senator Devlin and Marvin were just talking about a few minutes ago, but is adequate funding support for fire protection in eastern Oregon. Current funding mechanisms are falling short, inadequately supporting fire suppression, management personnel, and infrastructure in eastern Oregon. We, in regards to infrastructure, we have buildings in John Day and Prineville basically falling apart, and not the funding to keep them maintained or to get them improved. Productivity from these lands compared to western Oregon is less due to climate and other factors, and has less capability or ability to produce revenue for landowners to offset the protection costs. Fires that occur in eastern Oregon are heavily weighted to lightning and other non-landowner causes. Over the past 10 years, 67% of the state's lightning fires and 26% of the human caused fires have occurred in eastern Oregon, resulting in 70% of the state's acres burned. A partnership between landowners and the public through the general fund in support of forest fire protection has been in place in eastern Oregon for over 40 years. That same approach is now in place in western Oregon. However, it's a much newer approach. It was implemented in 1991. And we're thinking at this point an unintended consequence of these changes has actually resulted in a lower percentage of general fund support for eastern Oregon than what existed previous to 1991. Additionally, due to the loss of wood processing facilities, changes in landowner types, and fragmentation of large blocks of single ownership lands into smaller parcels, landowners' abilities to pay 50% of the costs and assist with firefighting resources has diminished. Growing consequences of these events has exposed both the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund and the state's general fund to higher costs and greater resource damage. Could you slide one up? I meant to put that up soon, but it's our trademark for how our fire funding works, but just wanted to hit this real quickly. I think several of you have seen this in the past, but the bottom line is the bottom of the Pulaski represents our district protection budgets, and that is the dollars that go in for paying for the fire engines, paying for the personnel, the crews that on each district in the state. The next little block above that is the district deductibles. Again, this comes out of the district's budget, and the significance of this is that these are roughly our landowner dollars, general fund dollars, and federal dollars. The match in that is roughly about for every one dollar of general fund within the match increases or leverages about another $3 either through landowner funds and also in a way back through the public or the public lands such as the federal lands and state lands that are funded in there. But you move above that, the $15 million block up there is the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. And then the $10 million block above is the general fund portion or the state's portion of that fund, which all becomes the deductible before we go into the state's catastrophic fire insurance, which provides another $25 million. And that's the point wanted to make in regards to this issue as well as the budget is, you know, in the end, through that, if we burn through the $50 million, then we're back into the state's general fund, so this all comes back to capacity and back to effective initial attack, stopping those fires. Number one, preventing the fires from beginning. The fire we don't have doesn't cost us anything, but then being effective with initial attack and maintaining the capacity to be effective at that. Any questions on that?
Please proceed. Whenever you're ready.
The next portion of the budget presentation does deal with our performance measures, and I'll just try and run through those pretty quickly. But KPM 16 is fire suppression effectiveness. Slide 4 relates to the percent of wildland forest fires under ODF jurisdiction controlled at 10 acres or less. Our strategy is to suppress wildfires on forest land while small to minimize firefighting costs and to minimize the resources loss. The measure demonstrates the effectiveness in the management of the resources under its control. And I just put this slide up. The point we're trying to make with it, with this measure as well as with this slide is, you know, there's basically what we'd call a sweet spot out here where we want to be for funding in regards to what's effective. As you increase funding, you move out. You don't, in once you pass this point, you're not buying that much more in protection, if I'm making sense. Conversely, if you slide back, you have great losses in regards to resource values as well as the costs of fires. So there's a point in here that's most effective at being with budgeted dollars. And so, you know, want to point out it. You know, throwing a bunch more dollars at it isn't cost effective at a certain point. Conversely, if you back off, you hit a trigger point where short, smaller reductions end up creating huge, greater losses in regards to the cost of suppression of fires as well as the resource damage that's occurred. And we did have a legislative note from the last session that instructed us to reevaluate the performance measure, take a look at it, and modify it if necessary. The target that we've had or given to reevaluate, given that all years show the target was exceeded in all but one year. After evaluation, we have determined that it's probably not necessary to make the adjustment or to make an adjustment. The measure has been in place for over 30 years. It is used nationally by other states and as well as the federal land management agencies, and it represents a key comparative benchmark that's pretty solid for us to stick with. The basis of this measure and the 94% target is it because burning conditions, changing fuel types, and the exposure of fire starts vary regionally and from year to year, it provides a consistent means to track our performance. Any questions? Moving on to... that might have been... Performance Measure 15. Moving on to Performance Measure 16, Wildland Firefighter and Safety.
Slide 11.
Lost time days per 1,000 fireland fire line exposure hours. Our strategy here is keeping our employees safe. It's our absolutely number one priority. The business of fire suppression is full of hazards, and this slide is just of a training session. Poor safety results results that can cause injury and death and employee morale problems as well as increased costs. The level of firefighting activities varies from year to year due primarily to the severity of weather patterns. Generally, however, wildfires are becoming more dangerous to fight. This increase is due to several interconnected trends, including weather conditions and increases in forest health. We mitigate the hazards through intensive training of firefighters and fire line supervisors. We are doing, at this point, very good. In both 2004 and 2005, we have not had any lost time injuries in regards to fire suppression activities. A real key point in this, to me, does go back to capacity. The more the system gets stretched, the more you drop back to maintain safety, and it has to be monitored very closely. And it's just a trade-off in amount of resources that we have, and in comparison to the numbers of fires that get started.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Question.
Yes. Please proceed.
How do you pay, and what's the average firefighter compensated? And I know that's hard because you don't know how long they're going to fight a fire, but do you have a base contractually that you work with the groups? And what's an individual paid to go out there and fight a fire?
Bill, if you want to...
I didn't realize it was that difficult a question.
Actually, why don't we make this the final sort of question, and then we'll just start back up on Monday. That's okay, because I don't think we'll get through the rest at this point.
Chair Devlin, my name is Bill Lafferty, Fire Program Director. Contracted resources, I'll use an example of contract 20-person crews. The average bid rate for per person per hour is in the neighborhood of $30 per hour that we would reimburse the company owner. That owner may employ anywhere from minimum wage to more experienced folks. You know, maybe $7-$8 an hour is a figure that I've heard that they would pay entry-level firefighters. Our organization's initial attack seasonal workforce is compensated entry-level, again, in the neighborhood of $10 or $12 an hour. And with experience and other responsibilities that goes up from that.
Thank you, Bill.
And why don't we just stop at this point, and we'll see you back Monday morning. So I'll make sure that if there are more questions, that there's time for those questions. So we'll just see you back first thing Monday morning at 8:30.
Sounds good.
Thank you. Public hearing closed.